This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
This is Mitchell Davis, host of Taste Matters. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Edition of Art Senses Seizures. And I'm expecting a lot more seizures than art this week with our very special guest, my good friend. Oh man, really getting into the crypt, Jack. That's right, Jack Inslee, producer of The Stars, is also back in the booth, but we're here with writer and comedian Kevin Mayer, star of the long-running series Kevin Geeks Out.
I never think of myself as the star of the show. I write it and produce it and host it.
And your name is in the title.
And my name is megalomaniacally in the title, but they're there for the theme. People are there for the theme, not me.
Yeah.
I also like that it sounds like we're coming at you live from a haunted house. We're here in Long Branch, New Jersey, from the ghost of the haunted mansion.
Where everybody died.
Well, the haunted houses have a tendency to burn down.
Yeah. All right, Jack's laying it on heavy today. I can dig it.
Okay.
This week we've got coming up, Kevin Geek has geeked out about many, many things. Together we have geeked out about professional wrestling, but you have geeked out about sharks. You've geeked out about the apocalypse, Star Wars. You've geeked out about sharks, all things we were going to talk about. You've geeked out about female robots. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get there. We're going to talk about the morality.
I want to play catch up.
I want to talk about the morality of having sex with robots because...
Definitely.
Because we go there. But this week for Halloween at the Nighthawk Cinema, which is in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, this Thursday, the 29th, at 9:30, you're going to be geeking out about...
Stephen King.
Stephen King, who I believe is the Democratic... I can't even say I was confusing with Bernie Sanders this morning. That's what kind of morning I've been having.
It's like Maine and Vermont.
Yeah, just some fucking New England nut bucket.
Yeah.
Although actually, Stephen King probably would make a good candidate for president.
Oh, he's involved in his local politics, from what I understand. He's a left leaning guy. It's one of those things. One of the things I personally like about Stephen King that I think people have made fun of is he still has this blue collar sensibility. He's been a millionaire for decades upon decades, but he still sees himself coming from this working class background, and he embraces that.
I think for him, writing is a job, which I love that that's the tact he takes. And boy, there was so much outrage when he was handed that National Book Award, that lifelong achievement thing. That's, you know, to the degree of, Truman Capote said about Jack Kerouac, that's not writing, that's typing.
Yeah.
It's because he's a genre writer and doesn't get the respect.
And he'll be the first one to say it. He says, my work is the literary equivalent of a Big Mac and a Coke.
But
I think he sells himself short. I think he sells himself short because if he does take him seriously, then the literati are going to make fun of him and ridicule him. But he actually has a lot going on, and that's why it's kind of perfect for a Kevin Geeks Out show, where we can talk seriously about wrestling or about Bigfoot.
Well, there's a great quote in Stephen King's book about writing, which is the one book that other, you know, quote unquote writers, and really I put that in quote because I know a lot of people here in in Brooklyn who really consider themselves writers, you know, with a big W. And he says, well, if you've written something, you sold it, and they gave you a check, and you cashed the check, and you used it to pay the power company, then I consider you a writer of some talent.
Yep.
And I think that's right, because there are a lot of people running around who haven't done that, and yet will poo-poo Stephen King because he is a horror writer.
He's a horror writer. He's a paid writer.
What I'd like to see, actually, is I would like to see a big bucket of pig's blood come down on Hillary Clinton during the next debate. this is kind of why I had the Bernie Sanders thing in my head.
I think that could only help her be that much more sympathetic.
You would think
so. Well, it's like anything in politics. It's not whether or not you get a bucket of pig's blood dumped on you. It's how you respond. It's how you deal with it. Do you burn down the National Democratic Convention, or do you accept it gracefully? You know?
Who do you want having that bucket of pig's blood dumped on them at 3 a.m.?
Who do I personally?
Well, that's what I'm just saying.
Oh, that's who you have to vote for.
That could be this year's ad.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of Stephen King's work. I mean, Carrie was his first book.
That was his first published book.
And I think the story goes, or legend has it, you can tell me if it's apocryphal or not, that he was writing it. He didn't know what the hell else he was going to do with himself. And he wrote this horror story, didn't like it, threw it in the trash. And his wife said, no, dumbass, you got to finish it. Mm-hmm. And
from what I understand, yeah, his wife salvaged it from the garbage. I think I want to say he was working as either a high school teacher or a substitute high school teacher, and he was just looking at the cruelty of young girls, and that's kind of what inspired it, and that she's the outsider, the outcast. And the more, you know, the more I look at Stephen King, the more you find these tropes of, like, the outsider. He writes about writers. He writes about people with psychic powers, kids with psychic powers. We'll look at some of the themes, and Carrie is where it all began for him. That was the big one.
Carrie's great. We should talk about Brian De Palma, too, who I cannot fucking stand. Talk about hacks of hacks. We can geek out about Brian De Palma, because that was the last good movie he made.
It's one of the most polarizing. It's really, De Palma's one of the most polarizing filmmakers I can think of.
Well, when you suck, that's what happens.
No, I have to champion Phantom of the Paradise. I can't stand here and let you badmouth Mr. De Palma.
Somehow I knew you would. I think what Carrie has got going for is two of the greatest female leads, you know, in history. I mean, Piper Laurie, obviously in Sissy Spacek. I mean, the combination and the chemistry between them is unbelievable, and the cruelty of the young, you know, John Travolta and his mates is very believable. It's very relatable. I mean, even as things are going flying around the house, there's a very real quality to carry.
I just heard, though, that part of the research I from my friend Tenebris Kate, she was in one of the wrestling shows we did, she said that at the time, Piper Laurie and John Travolta thought they were doing a parody of teen horror movies. So half the cast thought it was this big over-the-top comedy they were doing, and some thought they were doing a straight horror. And if you look at the film that way, that totally makes sense.
Such is the alacrity and deftness of that hack De Palma that even the people working for him didn't know what the fuck he was trying to do. You're not going to get a lot of nice words about Brian.
All right, we can move on.
I feel like he is, you know, I mean, there's a lot been talked about lately, cultural appropriation, but that guy but that's just out and out theft. I mean, you know, good ones steal and great, what do they say, good ones borrow and great ones steal, the mm-hmm. E. Cummings line about artists, but that's just fucking larceny. I mean, he steals some Hitchcock, but not even the good Hitchcock. You know, he's just like hack. The guy makes me so angry. Sorry. Antonioni. Yeah, I'm going to call it, like, you know, blow up and not blow out, or blow you, or whatever that movie was called. It's like, it's the same fucking movie, except not as good. But that's De Palma. So Stephen King, though, I think what we were talking about on the way over here was there were so many bad, quote-unquote, Stephen King movies that have the Stephen King brand on them
at the time,
are just, like, really bad movies.
I think at the time when I was a kid looking at a lot of these movies, growing up in New Jersey, I'd see these things on VHS when they first came out. It was like a new Stephen King. And at the time, not everybody talked about their personal brand. Branding wasn't a common thing that was thrown around. But I think it was one of my first experiences of getting into somebody who simultaneously had a brand that was known for something, but then, you know, he'd write a 4-page short story called The Lawnmower Man, and they'd make some horrible movie out of it, and they'd put his name on it, and sometimes they'd put his name over the credits of Stephen King's Graveyard Shift. So the bad movies and the direct videos and the sequels of the Children of the Corn movies, they really diluted what he was known for. Going into the show, I go back and I revisit the early stuff with John Carpenter's Christine or The Shining. And, you know, in the beginning, Cronenberg, all these big, heavy directors were really digging into his stuff. And I forgot how many good movies there are. I thought the show was going to be about the good bad ones and the bad bad ones, and you could make fun of the bad bad ones. But it's really more about appreciating just how many different kinds of Stephen King movies have been put out there.
Well, he's certainly prolific. He's been keeping the lights on for a long time.
Yeah,
writing these books.
Because he has to keep the lights on to keep writing. It's basically the old cocaine PSA, which is pretty appropriate.
I sort of picture him in my own way as the James Caan character in Misery. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's I know that. You know, I know he was in a bad car accident, Stephen King, right, as well?
Well, trucks is a big theme in his work, that there's so many evil trucks. I mean, just outside of Maximum Overdrive, there's a big truck crash that shows up in the movie of The Shining. Lots of truck accidents happen throughout his works. And apparently, the night TNT's Monster Vision with Joe Bob Briggs was showing Maximum Overdrive is the night he was hit by the truck, by the drunk driver.
Man,
So yeah, that's a theme.
Trucks are a theme. Mm-hmm. I guess we can go back to my favorite quote unquote Stephen King movie would be The Shining. I'm sure a lot of people feel that way after Carrie, which got a lot of controversy at the time as well. I mean, it's very big, it's very epic,
and that's another one. I mean, where it's all about the collaboration and the interpretation of the art. Thank you for that. It's Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Right. I mean, Kubrick was no friend of the writer. It's the story. You read Jim Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Thompson did the screenplay of The Killing. And the way they put the credits when Jim Thompson sat down and went to the premiere of The Killing, it said, The Killing, screenplay by Stanley Kubrick, story by the guy who wrote the book, dialogue by Jim Thompson. But Kubrick feels entitled to give himself the screenplay credit because he wrote the parentheticals.
We should geek out about Stanley Kubrick someday, too.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I mean, you know, as someone, another phenomenon we've talked to often on the show is, how many times have you read the Mad Magazine parody of a movie before actually seeing the movie?
Yeah, then you had all the spoilers, you know.
Especially R-rated movies when I was a kid, I definitely saw The Exorcist, by Mort Drucker before I saw The Exorcist.
Which is strange to me that it only occurred to me later as an adult, why was MAD always doing things that were R-rated that kids wouldn't know? And it was to their credit that they were doing stuff they wanted to do, and they were telling jokes that they found funny, which is why it wasn't condescending and talking down to kids.
So I think Stanley Kubrick gag is, in the Mad Magazine satire was called 201 Minutes of Space Idiocy. But a friend of mine recently saw it for the first time, right? Like
he saw 2001 or The Shining.
2001 for the first time, and said, "What a boring, pretentious piece of shit! It doesn't even make any sense." And my only—it was hard to argue. My only real answer was, "Yes, but you're missing the point." The Shining, when it came out, I was an inmate at the NYU Film School for about half a second when it came out, and all the smart asses there were saying, well, this is just a movie about a Steadicam. Because that was the new technology at the time. The Steadicam hadn't gained popularity yet, and it was all about those tracking shots and the big wheel, and that's why Kubrick decided to do this movie in a big hotel where he could shoot the kid on a big wheel riding around.
I just, in researching the show, I watched, and I'm not even necessarily going to use it anywhere, but I watched the three-part 90s miniseries of The Shining with Rebecca De Mornay and Steven Weber, directed by Mick Garris, and it was rough. It was rough. And it's like, I get that, Kubrick really took it and made it his own, and Stephen King felt like that wasn't the story he wanted, he really disliked it. And I guess the Kubrick estate, in order to allow him to remake The Shining, they said, if you sign a document that you will never on record badmouth Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, we'll give you the rights to remake it.
I wonder what he thinks about his other films. Has he been outspoken, Stephen King, about all these other productions?
He's not really
showing up to do the Q&A after the latest screening of Cujo at Nighthawk.
Yeah, I don't know. That's something I would have to.
Well, what are you guys going to address this Thursday night at the Nighthawk?
Well, Carrie, you mentioned Carrie, that gets talked about. Christine is dealt with.
Carrie, by the way, we could geek out about split screens too. I think that could be.
Oh my gosh, I love this.
We could do a whole show on split screens.
Yeah.
Okay, Christine.
I'm going to talk about It. Childhood trauma in It and memory in It and water imagery in It. There's tons of water in It, which gets into, I've geeked out about sharks and zombies in particular. I really love the aqua zombies, the aqua Nazi zombies that come up from shock. Well, every genre has its own subgenre, subgenre, and I enjoy shock waves. There you go. Shock waves.
I'm sorry, that was actually the
once aqua. They were almost human.
I was trying to get aqua Nazi zombies. That's I know it sounds like shockwaves, but it was really aqua.
Oh, I get it.
Not, I don't know. It's hard to make the theremin sound exactly like a swastika, but I tried.
But it's something I'm taken with of the idea of the water being the unconscious and, the creature of the Black Lagoon kind of coming up, the monster that lurks inside the unconscious.
A humanoid
waters.
From the deep,
A
perhaps?
Humanoid from the deep, if you will. Yeah, I love that stuff. And it has a lot of water imagery, so I'm going to kind of tackle that head on.
Well, I loved Humanoids from the Deep. We were talking about this before, and we're talking about... I've yet to see Sharknado. You geek out about sharks, and I'm a huge Jaws fan. We talked that possibly Steven Spielberg's last good movie.
I'd say it's his last great movie, and so much of that has to do with the setbacks of the movie and how the editor and the actors and the screenwriters all kind of stepped up and got involved so that it was less auteur than he gets credit for. It was such a collaboration. And I think if all of his films were done that way, where the editor is weighing in on, here's the shot you're going to need, here's what I need to piece together this movement, and then the actors ad-lib the scenes and the screenwriter finesses it with them, and the less the director's involved, the better a movie becomes. But with Jaws, I think what's fascinating with Sharknado and Jaws, it's very similar to the Stephen King stuff, which is when people adapt Stephen King movies, it's kind of like when somebody rips off Jaws, they have the shark and they think that's enough. But it's like the shark is one of the least interesting things about Jaws. The relationship between Brody and the town, being from New York, showing up, he's never going to be an Islander, the tension of him and his wife, or with Quint and the mayor and the guy who runs the newspaper. Let me ask you this. The last time I was on a podcast talking about Jaws, I said that Quint is an anti-Semite because he makes a thing about how Hooper's hands are soft from counting money all his life. And the guys on the show is like, no, he's not.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Oh, man. He saw Richard Dreyfuss and he just said, big fucking, you know, academic pussy, you know? Yeah. Here's a guy who does not work on the docks. That's all. Here's a guy who spends his time on a classroom. Not quite the same as, like, Henry Hill when Karen says, what do you do? I'm in construction. But your hands are so soft. Oh, I'm a union delegate, you know?
Right.
But
I think when people do Jaws knockoffs, it's similar to when a hack filmmaker takes a Stephen King short story or novel and makes a movie. It's like, oh, we're going to put in all the monsters, all the good stuff. And it's like King kind of comes in the tradition of Richard Matheson, these guys mm-hmm. who take fantastical ideas, but they ground it with real human reactions of, like, if this incredible, bizarre thing were to happen, let's have a very human reaction to it.
The motivating factor in Jaws is money. I mean, that's why they got to keep the beaches open. Mm-hmm. But we have a shark. You've got a shark problem. But we've got to keep the beaches open, like in Humanoids from the Deep, which we talked about. It's a great job. It's the salmon festival that weekend. Well, you don't seem to understand. There are these humanoids from the deep. But it's the salmon festival. And if we don't have a salmon
festival. There's always a festival. In Grizzly, there's the big backpacking picnic festival.
The car.
There's a...
A car!
In the car, because we were talking about this before, you've got the knockoff of Jaws is the... evil car. So instead of closing the beaches, we're not going to cancel the parade. So if you're ever on the fence, like Kingdom of the Spiders is a good example. We're not going to cancel the town circus. There has to be something that the monster can destroy and ruin and eat people at.
And the second the mayor says that, you know it's going south.
It's officially a Jaws knockoff once the mayor refuses to close the thing. And what's funny is I went to Jaws Fest in Martha's Vineyard a couple of years ago, and I was thinking,
nice.
How incredible would it be if there was a shark attack right before Jaws Fest and they said, we're not canceling Jaws Fest.
No, Jaws Fest must go on for the president's here. Obama's on vacation here and he demands Jaws Fest.
It was the last Jaws.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. I want to tell everybody that this Thursday, the 29th, go see Kevin at the Nighthawk Cinema in Williamsburg to geek out about Stephen King. And if you survive that, we're doing a special Cramps tribute at the Bowery Electric. It's starting at 11 o'clock, 11:30.
Excellent.
And it's featuring our friend John Spencer. We're going to hear his werewolf song right now while we take a quick break. You're listening to Hearts and Seizures. Fall out of my back. She gonna look way back into the back of my eyes. She said you done your baby wrong and you know you gonna die tonight. She said. Nothing left, you ain't a man no more, you're out of control. When the wolf name is blooming, you're gonna find out what it's like to lose your soul. Now my teeth are long, pentagram on my bone. Crazy, we're back here in Arts and Seizures with the great Kevin Mayer, star host, Generalissimo, of Kevin Geeks Out. Kevin's going to be geeking out about Stephen King this Thursday at the Nighthawk Cinema, and we just heard our friends at the John Spencer Blues Explosion geeking out about werewolves. That's a late show, so if you survive Kevin's stories about Stephen King, come see us at the Bowery Electric. We got a great cast of superstars. We're going to be doing all Cramp songs. for Halloween. Excellent. One weekend I saw on Halloween, one week I saw Black Sabbath on Friday and the Cramps on Saturday. It was like the best. Had I been able to fit the Misfits in there, it would have been like the holy
trial. When you said you were going to play the song She Said, I thought it was going to be the Hazel Atkins version because he's another great Halloween. If you're putting together a Halloween mixtape, we got a lot of great examples right there.
So I wanted to talk about Star Wars a little bit because I know you geeked out about Star Wars. There's a new Star Wars movie coming out, apparently. If anything's come close to breaking the internet, it's been this the new Star Wars trailer and people buying tickets in advance, and the buzz on this new Star Wars movie is kind of unbelievable. So is this the seventh Star Wars movie or the first one? I'm very, very confused.
It's episode 7, so it comes after Return of the Jedi.
So it's episode 7, so it comes after many... so it comes after the second one, and therefore is the seventh? Did I do that right?
Return of the Jedi was the third theatrically released, but it was episode 6.
So it's the fourth, but that makes it the seventh.
It's the seventh.
With the other two in the middle.
And I think it's 30 years or so between... I think it's supposed to be 30 years between episode 6 and 7. So maybe there will be some cartoons and TV movies and Cartoon Network specials that fill in those gaps, inevitably.
You think there'll be some merchandise surrounding this?
I don't know. Yeah, I think with Disney, you're going to see more toys. More toys than if you combined everything that came previously. You're going to see even more toys with Episode 7 and Star Wars and Disney. So that's inevitable. Here's what I wonder, though. At what point when somebody reads the screenplay, some corporate higher-up numbers cruncher reads a script, and it says, and you know, the characters, the heroes go off, and then they're being chased by a bounty hunter. At one point, somebody says, no, they're being chased by 5 bounty hunters. Because then you get 5 action figures and 5 plush toys and 5 of everything else. I have 2 boys, and I'll go see kids' movies, for better or worse. And we saw Cars 2. Some of them I get a lot out of it sometimes, but I was forced to go see Cars 2, and there's a scene where Mater, the Larry the Cable Guy character, is going to go undercover. So it's like the classic thing of the guy, it's like in Carrie, someone coming in and out of a changing room, trying on a lot of different outfits. He's like, I could go undercover as this or this or this. And he's in all these different outfits. And they're like, that was solely placed in the movie so that they can have 4 different
We live in an era where there are movies based on game shows. I mean, it was a Battleship.
Yeah.
I mean, what's next? Like Light Bright on the IMAX screen?
But even then, that's a known property that existed, so you don't have to introduce a new idea. I think one of the challenges, whenever I talk to people who are like new and they want to get started in like movies or TV, I always say one of the things that you're competing with, you're not just competing with a bunch of people your own age who have new ideas. If you want to go pitch something at Cartoon Network, guess what? They're going to have a new Scooby-Doo because they want to keep that property alive. You're competing with properties that have existed since the 1930s and 40s. And that the companies that own them, they just need to find ways to keep Looney Tunes going so that you have a whole back catalog that comes with it.
That back catalog.
The enemy. That stuff that you grew up loving, that's your own worst enemy.
Well, nostalgia being the national pathology.
It's eating its own
But thing. But that's what we're talking about, too. So what do we think about, you know, George Lucas, like, changing Star Wars movies? And this is the version of record now because it's changed. And, you know, unless you have the rare laser disc version,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it would be nice to be able to get,
see the original bar scene. I mean, isn't that one of the big things? Like, who shot first,
of course. Oh, man, this is... I don't think I'm going to bring anything new to the table here. We can talk about it. I'm happy to talk about it, but maybe that's the approach we'll take, is to what extent does the creator owe anything to the audience?
I say as long as they're keeping the lights on quite a bit. I mean, I think that's what Stephen King would say, is, you know, you're in business here now. And it depends on to what degree you think you are an artist, with, you know, with a big A or a small A or somewhere in between, with a sans serif or an italics or what have you. If you're an artist,
Well, I think
Stephen King, you know, is not that pretentious guy. He's, you know, like you said, he's that blue collar work a day guy. He says, I write 4 hours a day, 2,000 words a day. That's what pays the rent.
Yeah.
And you have another guy who, I don't know, he's created this empire, but years later wants to go back and tweak with it. But he got rich because of all he made you geek out. He turned you into the geek you are today.
I don't... Well, a whole other episode. I do not personally self-identify as a geek. I geek out as a verb, but I do not self-identify that way. It's a part of who I am.
Oh, God. Is this part of that whole gender fluidity conversation?
Yes, absolutely.
Of which
we don't have to go there. We don't have to go there.
So you're not even trans geek or cis geek?
No. It's something I do. I do it for... I do it for a very small paycheck.
Yeah, well,
I get a little bit of the door.
You get a little bit of the door.
But let me ask you, there's something like, yeah, is it wrong for George Lucas to change something if his audience, if his fan base doesn't want it? I would flip it where, you know, J.K. Rowling announced after the books were published, after the movies came out, she's like, I guess she said in an interview that, oh, yeah, Dumbledore's gay. What if people had hated that? I think because of the Harry Potter community being the way that it is, a lot of them celebrated that and they embraced it and they thought it was fantastic and wonderful.
And yet,
what if they hated it? Should she go back and say, oh, I was wrong. He was just going through a phase.
And yet, well, she's already cashed that check. And yet, cleverly, Dumbledore sucks not a cock in all 7 books.
That's not going to be in a young adult book.
Well, I've read those books. I enjoy it.
When Dumbledore talks about the magic wand, what do you think he's talking about?
Oh, they're all gay. They go to magic school, for Christ's sakes. I don't know what to say about that. That she says later that he's gay. I mean, I don't know that it's relevant. It hasn't changed any plot points, has it?
I don't think it's changed any plot points, but what if the people who paid the checks, what if everyone came out and said, no, we don't think Dumbledore should be gay? Then what does she do? What does she do in that situation? It's all subtext, so I think that's an unusual example, as opposed to something like who shoots who first. That's more of a contentious item that people will debate.
So Dumbledore is sort of like the man who shot Liberty Valance in that. if the myth outsells the man, we're going to sell the myth.
I guess.
Or something. The man who shot Voldemort.
Let me ask you a question. I was talking about this with a friend of mine who's a film programmer. Can you think of anything, any movie or pop culture event or like celebrity wedding that is as anticipated as the new Star Wars? I can't think of anything in my lifetime.
Wow, even I'm excited. And I was so burned out by the Star Wars experience. I mean, I loved the first movie. I saw it at the Menlo Park Theater. You know, it was, for me, it was definitely that's very transcendent, you know, experience. It really pushed me on my way to wanting to become a filmmaker. And
yeah.
And it was like, and not even a filmmaker, I wanted to make movies. I mean, movies and big lights and like the biggest possible way. I mean, I just remember that first scene. If you recall, Star Wars was one of the first pictures that had like Dolby sound and surround sound, and it was presented, you know, with like a level
an
of quality.
Yeah,
you know, this motion picture
sensation experience.
You know, of course, they didn't have the shaking seats of Earthquake.
They didn't have the Tingler.
We had the Tingler. We can geek out about William Castle someday.
Oh,
the movie gimmicks. I love movie gimmicks.
Like William Castle. Yeah, I just found out recently that I know they gave away barf bags at The Exorcist, but 3 years earlier there was
Suspiria.
A movie. Mark of the Devil.
Mark of the Devil. Mark of the
Mark
Devil.
Mark of the Devil did it first.
Yeah. I remember the Mark of the Devil barf bags. It was great. And we're talking about The Tingler, which was the movie where you had to sign the release to watch it.
He
parked ambulances outside.
Yeah, there's
and there was a moment, if you were too scared to watch the last 30 seconds of this film, you may leave now.
Corner.
You had to go to Coward's Corner and walk the chicken line, the yellow line, to get your money back.
Yeah.
If you were too scared to watch the last
My favorite Castle gimmick was that, is it in Mr. Sardonicus where the audience gets to decide if the villain should be killed or not? They only filmed the ending where he gets killed because Castle's like, nobody's gonna say he shouldn't get killed.
Back to Star Wars for 1 second. It's like, the great thing was at the beginning, it was like the first ship goes overhead, it goes whoosh, and yeah. You know, it's the first time I'm hearing sound coming from behind me, and it's like, wow, that was like really cool. I think I had discovered pot like that afternoon also.
Oh, that's
probably didn't hurt the experience. But like, wow, I hope they do that again. And they do it again. The next one's the giant freighter. It's like, yeah. It's like, wow. And just the whole thing, you know, it's like Rebels. I mean, it's this rock and roll spirit, and you know.
Well, you had said, because I said,
and it was anti-establishment.
Well, I said on social media, this is, we can disagree about this, that I said it's the first movie after the Green Berets. It was the first movie to come out of Vietnam that's a pro-war movie where a young boy goes to war and becomes a man. And then you take the side that it's they're on the side of the rebellion.
Yeah.
And it is anti-establishment.
Yeah. Yes, Darth Vader, Dick Cheney. I mean, we saw that later. It came to pass.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to see it. I'm not going to see it.
Not only am I going to go see it, I'm going to like hold like fake lightsaber battles in front of my house on President Street and beat up the neighborhood kids. Of course I'm going to go see it. I'm going to be there like on day one in the IMAX 3D stoned out of my fucking head. I cannot wait. I mean, I love big movie experiences like that. I love movies, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like, I like films, too. You know, I mean, Bicycle Thief, it's a nice film.
And
then there's Planet of the Apes. Oh, man.
Shown up in so many other shows, but we've never done a full-on dedicated Planet of the Apes show.
Please, can we geek about monkeys and apes?
I think it's so much of it. I think there are some people who are like, I couldn't possibly keep up. That it's like a soap opera that people think they don't know it. It's tricky.
Planet of the Apes is ripe, though. You know, I'll tell you this, though. Beneath the Planet of the Apes, not as good as a movie as you probably remember it to be. When I was a kid, first we watched them all on Apes Week on the 4:30 movie.
Of course.
I think I saw Planet of the Apes on at a drive-in, too, the Plainfield Edison drive-in. So I actually may have seen it on the big screen for the first time. But Planet of the Apes was shown Monday and Tuesday because on those 4:30 movies, they had to edit a two-hour movie into a 90-minute slot minus commercials. So
The commercials take up 45
minutes. So they chopped. So you take a two-hour movie and chop it to like 105 minutes or whatever it is. And that's what they would show. So day three was Beneath the Planet of the Apes and Conquest and maybe Escape and, I don't know, some other goddamn monkey madness.
But Beneath the Planet of the Apes says the best G-rated movie ending of all time.
Well, it is a nuclear death cult.
Yeah.
There is that. And it does take fantastic. Place in the New York City subway.
Yeah.
And there's that whole reveal our inner selves. But I think if you go back and you watch it, it's all those highlights that are so singed in our memory.
It's all in the last 15 minutes. Yeah. There's a lot of walking around the subway tunnels.
Well,
I watched it with my kids. I got the Blu-rays, and I couldn't believe this. They were bored by the first two movies. I thought, okay, well, the third one's a light comedy. They'll take that. They didn't take it at all. It wasn't until Caesar shows up. They loved the fourth one, and then they thought the best movie was Part 5, which is universally reviled.
Wait, the one that's like... looks
Battle
like,
for the Planet of the Apes with the school buses and Seven Darden and Paul Williams in the chimp costume.
By the fourth one, I was watching it. It looked like an episode of I Dream of Genie. That's how poorly produced it was. It was like,
where's
fucking Major Nelson? Is this going to show up at any fucking moment?
I think it's my favorite sequel of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, man, there's so many moments. I could talk about Planet of the Apes forever. I mean, it never fails. It's my favorite line in the whole movie. It's not obviously the big reveal at the end. Yeah. It's the big one, but it's when Charlton Heston says to Dr. Zaius, "Would a monkey make a human doll that talks?" God damn it, busted. Fucking Dr. Zaius, God damn it. All right, everybody go see Kevin Geeks Out About Stephen King this week. Kevin is the greatest guy from beyond the earth. We've got a lot more to talk about. So much more. So please come back soon. We haven't even talked about the morality of having sex with female robots.
I will definitely come back and we'll talk about that.
Okay, Jack, what do you think? Is it cheating? Jack, is that your girlfriend I see in the boot there? Ask her, is it cheating if you had sex with a female robot?
Let's see. The jury says...
And does it make a difference whether you knew she was a robot before or after?
She says no.
She says no, that's not cheating. Wow.
That's not.
it's a very liberal network we work for. All right. We're going to see you guys next week on Arts and Sears. Looks like I got a very, very special guest coming in. I'm hoping the great Lisa Carver is going to come in and talk about her new book, 25 Lives. That's a real treat. But go see Kevin Geeks Out About Stephen King this week, Thursday the 29th. That's the Nighthawk Cinema right here in Williamsburg. Kevin's shows are always fantastic. And don't forget that this is listener-supported radio. If you're listening on your internet machine and see a button that says, give us money, donate, be a member, give blood, take a bite, one of those goddamn things, push a button, be a geek, be one of us. It's a lot more pleasant than you could ever imagine. All right, we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.